just been turning in large circles at some point. And so I noticed that as we were going through the store, I should have changed carts, but I didn't. As we're going through the store, I had to push it at about a 20 to 30 degree angle to the left to walk straight down the aisle. Have you ever had that happen to you? And if you push the cart the easy way, then the cart just had a tendency, this one just kept going to the right. And it was going to continue to go to the right, and it had to exert a great deal of effort to get it to go the path that you wanted it to go on. That's exactly what this lesson is about this morning. This lesson has been preached here before. There are several people in this congregation that have heard this lesson before, and the elders had asked me if I would preach it again. And what we're doing is preaching it as a part of a very small series. There's going to be at least one more lesson that's tied to this lesson, and then possibly one more following that, where we're going to talk about how some of the concepts that we'll mention in this lesson are possibly affecting us from time to time. The lesson's entitled The Three Chairs, and the intent is that each of us should ask the question, as I'm giving myself just a little more room here. Hopefully that'll make Judy feel a little better. She had great fears that I was going off the front edge sometime this morning. Hopefully that will not happen, because I'm going to be moving about from chair to chair. That's part of the intent of this lesson. And it's intended to help us understand where it is that we are in life and why it's important that we understand that, because much the same as that cart had that tendency just to kind of slide, God talks about that kind of thing happening with us in our spiritual lives, both individually and collectively. That the concept of drifting or moving in an area that you're not necessarily attempting to go is very much a biblical concept. That things left alone have a tendency to head toward that which is worse rather than toward that which is better. And so we want to do this to talk about why it is that churches do that, so that we as a collectivity can understand where is it that we are and how is it that we're going to make sure we're in the right chair and that we're accomplishing the right thing. But in the meantime, as you're considering that as a collectivity, also as individuals, where we are, because that happens generationally with churches as it happens generationally with individuals. You're going to see, and all you really need to do is just look historically in most places, find how many congregations of God's people that you can locate that were meeting 100 years ago. They are few and far between. There are very few congregations that stay strong and stay located in such a fashion that you can find them 100 years down the road. That's very infrequent. Most congregations that last a long term are generally, recorded to have lasted somewhere between 50 and 80 years. That's those that have lasted a long time. If that's the case, how do we prevent that? That's what we want to talk a little bit about this morning. Or look at families. We know that happens familial-wise as well, that families have a tendency to digress in their strength and digress in their faith rather than growing stronger with each passing generation, unless there's a great deal of effort that is exerted. And so what we're going to do is each of these chairs is going to represent a position or an attitude that we're going to talk about. And this first chair is a chair of commitment. And what we want to do as we talk about these, and this is not the epitome of laziness, this is just to make a point. I told Bailey and Maddie I was going to sit in one and call them up to sit in the other two before we started this morning, and shook them a little bit, but we're not going to do that. I just want you to feel comfortable through the rest of the lesson. How do you know who sits here? It's interesting as you look generationally what happened in the Bible. If I were to pull out a Bible character like Joshua and say, what chair would you put Joshua in? Would you not put him in this chair here, the chair of commitment? Wouldn't you expect that that's where Joshua is? Look at Joshua chapter 24. This is one of the great leadership statements made in all of God's Word. In Joshua chapter 24 and verse 14 starting, now therefore fear the Lord, serve Him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the river and in Egypt. Serve the Lord. And if it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. There's no question. I can't imagine that there would be anybody here this morning who would say, you know what, Joshua doesn't really belong in the chair of commitment. I would put him somewhere else. Joshua made one of the great committal statements in all of the Bible and lived by that statement. And we understand that because we're going to read that the generation that was under Joshua, the elders that survived Joshua, at least maintained some level of God's word for an entire generation. But then things change, because if you look at Judges chapter 2, and you look at the generation that followed Joshua, then I would tell you, and there was only two people you remember in Joshua's generation that were still in the land of Canaan, just Joshua and Caleb. But then there was the whole generation that followed Joshua, and in Judges chapter 2 and verse 7, so the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua. And I would tell you, on the surface, that would sound like that generation belongs in the chair with Joshua, don't they? That sounds like a generation that belongs in the chair of commitment. They served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord which he had done for Israel. And if you stopped right there, I would tell you that you'd probably put them in the chair of commitment. But I don't think that's where they belong. I think that they belong in this middle chair, which is the chair of compromise. That this generation is not committed the way Joshua is committed. And how do we know that? Even though it says they served the Lord, it's interesting that it says they served the Lord and they had seen all the great works the Lord had done for Israel. They saw something, but they didn't really have the same relationship as Joshua. And we know that because in verse 8 we read, now Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died when he was 110 years old. And they buried him within the border of his inheritance at Timnath-Heres and the mountains of Ephraim on the north side of Mount Gash. But when all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose, and now we're removed one more generation from Joshua. Here's a generation that's not in the chair of compromise, but here's how you know the generation that preceded them was in the chair of compromise. Here's a group that's in the chair of rebellion. They turned completely away from God. When all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord nor the work which he had done for Israel. It said this group over here knew. This group knew what God had done, but this group didn't. How would it be possible that I know what God has done and my children don't know what God has done? There's only one way for that to be possible. I didn't tell my children. This generation compromised. Something pulled them away from God to a level at least enough that their religion or their spirituality didn't pass on to the next generation because their children didn't have a relationship with God and didn't even know the things that God had done. That's what compromise does. It's interesting. There was a report done a few years ago about this very concept. A man traveled all across the country meeting with those who were worshiping in churches, trying to find out what had happened in three generations of the people that were in those congregations. And he said, almost without fail, that those who sat in the chair of commitment, almost without fail, they never had children, as a general rule, who sat in the chair of rebellion. They did have some that sat in the chair of compromise whose children sat in the chair of rebellion. But those who were truly, totally committed to God didn't generally see it skip that entire step. That's the nature of drifting. I'm not saying nobody does. There have been people of committed parents who have just absolutely, totally chosen to walk away from God. We understand that. But that's not the general rule. And that continues to happen as you look biblically at other people. If I were to mention the name Abraham, where would you put Abraham? I think clearly we would say Abraham, the father of the faithful. Abraham clearly belongs in the chair of commitment. This was a man of incredible commitment. If you look in Genesis chapter 12, you see something that is true about Abraham and remained true of Abraham the whole time you find him and his journeys in this book of Genesis. In Genesis chapter 12, verse 7, the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your descendants I will give this land. And there he built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. In verse 4 of chapter 13, it says, to the place of the altar which he had made there at first. And there Abram called on the name of the Lord. In verse 18, and then Abram moved his tent and went and dwelt by the terebinth trees of Mamre, which are in Hebron, and built an altar there to the Lord. That is just the description you get of Abraham over and over again. Everywhere he moved, he built an altar to the Lord and worshiped God. And you see him in that mode. You understand that Abraham was called the father of the faithful because he was a man who did what God told him to do, who trusted in God. He believed God and gave him his whole heart. We're not saying he didn't make mistakes. Even those that sit in the chair of commitment made mistakes. Abraham got scared and lied about the relationship with his wife for fear of his life. But he was a man that was committed to God. But it's interesting because if you remove yourself one generation from Abraham, I would tell you Isaac belongs here. Isaac is in the chair of commitment, in the chair of compromise. And you find Isaac in the chair of compromise for several different reasons. In Genesis chapter 25, it tells us of Isaac that he loved one son better than the other. Why? Do you remember why? Because he brought him meat. He brought him meat. Because of the game that he brought. Because of food, one son was more important to him than the other. It wasn't the spiritual direction of these children that made the biggest difference to Isaac. It was what that son could do for him. And when you read about him, one time in the scriptures do you read of Isaac building an altar. In Genesis chapter 26, he built an altar, and at that altar he dug a well beside the altar. And what you find out is, you read about him over and over and over again digging wells. Isaac is known as the great well digger of the nation of Israel. Isaac took care of himself first, God second. He was in the chair of compromise, and so what did he raise in his children because he sat in the chair of compromise? Because he loved food, and that made a difference to him more than spiritual things. Isaac has a son by the name of Esau, who clearly sits over here. Esau was a man who turned away from God, a man who was at great enmity with his brother Jacob. He was a man who gave himself over to idols. He was a man who allowed himself to worship false gods. He had turned from two generations, from Abraham to Isaac to Esau. You've got a man who has given himself over to the false gods of the land, the kind of gods that Joshua had talked about. You're going to have to choose where you go. But Abraham served God. Isaac served God, but at a different level. Esau really wasn't even serving God. But even if you look at Jacob. Jacob, he appears to be a great character, and he later turns out to be a good character for God. He's one of the patriarchs, but he didn't start out that way, did he? The compromise of Isaac had an effect on Jacob. And so because his mother loved him when his father loved his brother, he conspires with his mother to go in and steal the birthright from his brother. Sells his, or gets his brother to give him his birthright for a bowl of stew. Do you ever just think about that? I mean, I understand if you've got brothers, you understand that. I've got brothers. There were times that they came into the house where they would ask me for something, and as a brother, I should have said, absolutely. I love you as my brother. What is mine is yours. Ask either one of my brothers if that ever happened. Not likely. I might sell it to them like Jacob did. You know what? You give me this, I'll give you that. That's what Jacob did. His name itself means usurper. The idea of tripping. Remember that kid that used to walk down behind you in the hall at school? Kick your heel? So that when you was walking, your foot flew over and hit your other leg and you stumble forward, maybe fall on your face. They got a big joke out of that. That's Jacob. That's the name. Usurper, one who trips up somebody else. That's exactly what he did to his brother. But you had Abraham in the chair of commitment, you had Isaac in the chair of compromise, and so consequently the boys find themselves in the chair of rebellion. But he's not the only one. Where would you put King David? I mean, as you deal with a man who God says, even with his sins, even with his problems, he was a man that God's own description is, he was a man after God's own heart. I would have to put David here. This was a man that was dedicated to God. And even when he sinned, and even when he made mistakes, and he did things that were wrong, you find David giving himself over to God. Being willing, when Nathan the prophet came to him and said, you are the one that I'm talking about. You're the sinner here. What did David do? David falls on his face and says, I have sinned against my God. When David numbered the people and people died because he had transgressed what God wanted him to do, and they confronted him with that, what did he say? He said, I have sinned greatly before God. And he threw himself on the mercy of the throne of God. It isn't that in the chair of commitment you're without mistake. It's what your dedication level is. But David wasn't such a great father. He had sons that didn't do so well. He had a son that wanted to overthrow his kingdom, Absalom. Wanted to steal the kingdom away from David. He had a son, Adonijah, that wanted to do the same thing. And it says specifically of Adonijah in Kings that David just never corrected him. It says at any time he never said, why are you doing this? And so he set himself up and said, I'm going to be king. And he assembled chariots and horses to go against his father, the king. But he had one son that appeared to be better than the others, but where would you put him? If you took Solomon, where would you put Solomon? The man who had wisdom above all men on earth, you'd have to put Solomon here in the chair of compromise. Why? Because Solomon was willing to marry all those foreign wives after God had said, don't marry those foreign wives. They will take you away from God. They'll lead you into idolatry. And that's exactly what happened, wasn't it? The nation of Israel starts a downhill slide now because you've got a king, the son of David, sitting on the throne, who's a man of compromise. Why? Because he was interested in worldly pursuits. If you go through the book of Ecclesiastes and read what appears to almost be a journal of Solomon's life, you see Solomon saying, you know what, I've tried everything. I took care of myself with my possessions, and I took care of myself with pleasure. I took care of myself with wisdom and folly. Everything was focused on him. Remember Solomon building the temple? How long did he spend building the temple? Do you remember that historically? We're told in Kings he spent 7 years building the temple. 7 years in 1 Kings chapter 6. Very end of the chapter. Do you know how chapter 7 starts out? But he spent 13 years building his own house. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? Solomon's palace was every bit as much as Solomon's temple. It's no wonder when the Queen of Sheba came, she said, wow, it hasn't even the half of it been told. You could look at what Solomon had. He had bought into the worldliness and the things of the world, and he wanted those possessions, and he had those possessions. And he became a child of compromise. And so what did he raise? Isn't it interesting in Ecclesiastes, he says, you know what? You can assemble a life where you acquire great money. And he said, do you remember who he said you leave it to? In Ecclesiastes, it said, you're going to leave it to a fool. He should have known, didn't he? Because here sits Rehoboam, the son of Solomon. The son who divides the entire kingdom of God. A kingdom that for 120 years had remained united under one king. A country that was together, who now under Rehoboam, because of his foolishness, severs the very kingdom of Israel into the northern and the southern kingdom. And it says of him that he bowed down and worshipped idols. He's completely away from God now. But that just happens. Generationally, that happens. It's a drift. It's what causes you to move. And you could look at others. It's just that God recorded those very specifically for us. And you can see that slide that's happening that direction. And we know that that happens because of that lack of effort. You have to put forth. I can tell you, when I left Sam's that day, and you can ask Judy, I was not overly happy. And we picked up 2 bags of charcoal. You know, so you got 46 pounds, and I throw them in the bad cart. Now I'm having to push it at an angle twice as hard, same angle, but twice as hard to get it to go remotely straight. People that were coming down the aisle when we were going outside probably are thinking, what is wrong with this guy? He's not even walking remotely the right direction. I'm just skidding the wheels along the parking lot. It took an incredible amount of effort to get that cart to go straight. But it wouldn't have taken any effort at all to let it go to the right. I could have pushed very easily and let it drift. And that's the nature of drifting. We understand that. By its very definition, it's moving with the flow. And so if Jesus tells us that there is a straight path that heads toward heaven, and there is a broad path that leads toward hell. And he says, and I'm telling you that the majority of the flow is on the big path going the wrong way. Which path do you think is easier to walk on? It's just easier to get caught in the flow. There's nobody that I know that would make an argument that the world is leading us in a right direction. That if you'll just hang on to the world, they'll drift you the right way. We know that's not true. It takes real effort to stay in that chair. It takes double effort to get from this chair into that chair, and it takes an incredible effort to get from this chair into that chair. You have to put forth some real effort to go. So we just want to ask ourselves this question then this morning. What is it that allows this to happen? What's the thought process? What's the action that causes me to get from that chair of commitment if that's where I started? And hopefully everybody that was ever baptized into Jesus Christ started in that chair. Otherwise, what was the point of ever being baptized into Christ? I mean, isn't the very nature of subjecting oneself to the teaching of God and willing to go down into the waters of baptism come up? Isn't that the very definition of the idea of commitment? Jesus said, whoever will take up his cross. You're going to have to kill yourself, your life, so that you can live for God. That's where we all started. Then why doesn't everybody stay there? Because of the effort involved. Just three things that I want to look at this morning. One, there's a difference in the way that they view time. I would tell you the person that is sitting in the chair of commitment is a person that lives in the present. This is a person that understands that it is today that matters. Jesus said, look out unto the field, they are white unto harvest. The person that sees the fields white unto harvest, that today there is great opportunity. Today the Lord is working. He's in my life today. He was in my life yesterday, but He's in my life today. And He's doing great things today. What happened with that generation of Joshua's time was they had seen the things that God had done. What didn't they see? They didn't see what God was doing. You have to live in the present. You have to understand that that is the nature of serving God. When Jesus said, this day, just one day at a time, understand that God is working today. Work with Him today. You can't focus backwards or forwards. Paul said, you know what? Forgetting that which is behind in Philippians chapter 3. I've forgotten what's behind. Were there good things behind, Paul? Yeah, there were good things. Paul said, I'm telling you, I had some serious credentials in that past life, but I've forgotten what's behind. It doesn't matter if it's good or bad. What if it was bad? I look behind. I can tell you, I look behind. Mine at one point was not good. I'm not leaving behind good things. I feel just as good, though, to leave it behind. He's saying it doesn't make any difference. I'm not living with God in 1973 or 4 prior to being a Christian. That's not where I live with Him. I live with Him in 2011. He says, this is the day. Isn't that what the psalmist said? This is the day that the Lord has made. I will rejoice in it. I'm going to be glad. Because this is a great day. I'm in it. God's in it with me. How can it not be a great day for me? That's what God is saying. You've got to live in the present. Or you can be in this chair of compromise because they have a tendency to live in the past. These are the people who are saying, oh, you know what? You remember when? You remember when we used to have gospel meetings that lasted 2 weeks and people would come and people responded and that there were people baptized to those meetings? Do you remember those days? He says that's the behind part. What is God doing today and what are you doing with God today? You've got to live in the present. You can't focus on the past. That we feel good about ourselves because of something we did last year. Can't you just imagine your child coming home from school that's got that bad report card? They've got a couple of those D's and maybe an F or two even on a report card. And don't you just imagine as a parent when your son or daughter says, yeah, but remember last year when I made B's and C's and I made some A's? Don't you just see yourself as a parent saying, you know what, I'd forgotten all about that. I'm so sorry that I'm upset about this one. You know what, I'm just so thankful you made good grades last year. I mean, that's ludicrous. That wouldn't change our attitude at all, would it? Last year doesn't matter. Isn't that what you'd tell your child? There'd be a tendency probably to get aggravated enough to say it in a tone maybe we even shouldn't say it in. But I don't care about last year. I care about right now. What are you doing right now? You think that's not true of churches and Christians? You ever think that God's in heaven going, man, you know, I remember back in 58 when my word actually did something in the land. Back in those days, my word worked. Oh, those days were good, weren't they? Or do you think God is saying, my word will not return void, and that means 2011, the same as it meant in 1950 or 1910 or AD 33? God says, my word works today, just like it did before. He says, you've got to live here. The Jews lived right here in the past. You remember the Jews when a discussion in John chapter 8 with Jesus? Jesus says, you guys are just in bondage. And man, they just got mad. Don't tell us we're slaves. We've never been slaves. We're God's children. We are children of Abraham. You remember them saying that? And he told them again. And they said, you can't tell us we've never, ever been enslaved. We are the sons of Abraham. And Jesus said, no, you're not, because you're not doing what the sons of Abraham did and what Abraham did. But they were relying on that. There's a parallel for that for us, isn't there? How safe do you feel making your defense for your salvation because of being here? And I'm not saying just this morning. I'm saying my association. I'm a member of the Church of Christ. Don't you realize, if any of us said that to Jesus, Jesus would just say, are you? It isn't based on your lineage. It isn't based on your past. It's based on what you are and who you are right now. Our relationship. Those in Matthew chapter 7 that Jesus said, depart from me, I never knew you, weren't people that were just totally disregarding him at all costs. They were people that thought they were related. He's just saying, make sure you understand, you've got to live in the present. Because if not, you're going to be in this chair of compromise. You're going to raise a generation of those that are in the chair of rebellion. Secondly, there's a difference in the way that they view authority. There are those that say, you know what? I need to sit right here in the chair of commitment, and I'm going to do what God tells me to do. It doesn't matter if it makes sense to me or it doesn't make sense to me. I'm going to do what God tells me to do. There is one authority for my life, and that is God. I'm not going to allow man to dictate to me what I can or can't do or what I must or must not do. We're studying the book of Galatians right now, and there's both sides of that equation. There are men who would tell you, don't worry about anything at all. There are men who would tell you, you've got to do this, such as in Galatians, they were saying, you have to be circumcised. He's saying, my authority rests in the Word of God. And I need to make sure that I am doing what the Word of God says. God has placed authority over us and expects us to follow what He teaches us. Not what man does, but the chair of compromise is the one that has the tendency to add those kinds of things to it. You know what? I know that's what God said, but. You ever heard anybody say that? I know that's what it says, but. This is what I think. Or but that was then. Their culture was different then. The truth is different now is the idea. It can't work that way. If I'm going to compromise on authority, then there's no basis upon which I can establish a real truthfulness. And so there are those that take a different position toward authority. Are we going to give our whole heart to God, everything He asked of us? When God told Abram, you need to get up and move, Abram just got up and moved. But not everybody does that. You remember in Jeremiah chapter 3, there's a great little recording there for us of an exchange through the prophet of God to the people of Judah. And he's basically saying this. He's saying in that and in the previous chapter. He says, Israel turned away from God, the northern kingdom. They turned away from God. Absolute treachery, he says. And he says, and I turned them over to captives. I took care of them for their treachery. I put them in a position that they should have been in. But then his point is, he's saying, and so what did Judah do because they saw all this? Says, Judah did not give me their whole heart. He said, in spite of the fact of what they saw me do to the nation of Israel, the northern kingdom. He said, they still didn't give me their whole heart. They gave me a pretense, he says. That's the idea of the chair of compromise. When it comes to the authority of God, it's God influences my life, but he doesn't direct my life. But there's a difference in those two things. I've been influenced by some people, and they've had an effect on my life, but I would never say that I wholeheartedly follow them. And that's kind of the difference in this position. Am I going to follow exactly what God tells me to follow? Nothing more, nothing less. Either side of that equation is no better than the other. You're no safer because you overbind than you are because you overloose. We understand that. God has given us a path to walk on, but he says you do need to make sure that you understand there is a path and that he does want us to walk that path. In Galatians, that's why he's talking about they had perverted. They had changed. It wasn't really another truth. It was a perversion of the truth. And then thirdly, there's a difference also, not only in the way they view time, not only in the way they view authority, but there's a difference focus in life. These people over here in the chair of commitment are like Paul in Galatians chapter 2 when he said, I've been crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live, yet not I, but Christ lives in me. In the life I live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. Paul says, it isn't even about me at all. It's about God. Those people sitting here understand the statement in Hebrews chapter 12 when the author of Hebrew letter says, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. He says, that's the only place I'm ever focused. I've set a goal for myself, and that is the focus of my life. I want to serve God with everything that I have. When we talk about some of the ways we've allowed culture to affect us, the question would be to even ask ourselves sometimes, did I start the day off by considering, how exactly would Jesus want me to behave today? How would he want me to behave? What would he want me to say? How would he want me to act at work? How would he want me to act at school? How would he want me to treat the people that I bump into? How, whatever the case is, am I thinking, it doesn't matter what comes natural to me, what does God want me to do? He becomes the focus of my life. And it's all-encompassing. Every aspect of my life is directed by God. But those that sit in the chair of compromise are those that they look at things differently. They start to compartmentalize life. God is there in my life. And if you were to draw it out like a pie chart, they'd draw you a section that represents God. And there might even be a tendency to make that section as big as possible, but it doesn't make any difference. You can't give God a big enough section of the pie if you're dividing your life into compartments. He doesn't want the biggest section of the pie. He wants the whole pie. He says, I have to be the total focus of your life. And it doesn't matter what you're doing. I need to permeate what you do at work, what you do at school, what you do when you're here together. I need to permeate your recreation, your choices in life. I need to be the backdrop of all of that. It's just a different focus in life. Are we going to give ourselves absolutely, totally, wholeheartedly to God? Or as Paul wrote to Timothy, is there a danger of having a form of godliness? A form of godliness. Isn't it interesting that God says, I like you better if you sit here or you sit here than if you sit here? I mean, there'd be a tendency to think, you know, this is the most desirable. This is the next most desirable. This is the least desirable. But when God wrote to the church at Laodicea, He said, that just isn't true. He says, I would that you were here or here. Because everybody knows where you stand then. Including God, He knows of all of us. But He knows, everybody else knows where you stand. But He says, because you're here, He says, I want to spit you out of my mouth. It is disgusting to God if we sit here. God says, I'd rather you slide all the way into the chair of rebellion so there's no doubt as to where you stand and everybody knows where you stand than to sit in the chair of compromise. And I would tell you that's written to a congregation of God's people, not an individual. I tell you, God dislikes it as much as an individual, but He's writing to a whole congregation. He says, you've got to make sure. You've got to make sure that where you're trying to sit is right here, and that's what we need to do. And if you're sitting in the chair of rebellion today, you need to give yourself back to God. He's given you time today to do that. The fact that we're here, and is an acknowledgement by God that He allowed us to reach this point so that somebody might take that opportunity to come back to Him. In Revelation chapter 3, when He talked to the church that was sitting here, He said, repent. Turn back to God. Get back where you belong. And that's what He would want us to do. He says, we need to make sure that we're exerting all the effort we can to stay right here in the chair of commitment. Not only for our own welfare, but I would tell you, if you sit in the chair of compromise, there is very little chance that either you won't slide to the chair of rebellion or that you won't raise a generation of people who are in the chair of rebellion. That's just the nature of the way it works. God says it's going to take everything you have to hang on right over here. That's a hard enough life to stay in and to raise children in and to raise grandchildren in. But He says you've got to stay there to have a chance of doing that. If you find yourself here, understand that God says you're endangering yourself and others. Give yourself to God. He wants our absolute, total, whole service. Even though we make mistakes, I know I'd rather sit with Joshua and Abraham and David right here than I would with that generation that followed Joshua or Isaac or Solomon right here, because I don't want to end up here for sure. And because we have three sons, I don't want to see my sons here. And I don't want to see their children here. And so it becomes necessary for me to do everything I can to stay right here so I can be that influence for God that He wants me to be. If you're not a Christian, I would tell you, God wants nothing more in this life for you right now today than for you to come to Him and start your life right there in that chair of commitment. And then rest on God's love, His help, the help of your brethren, those that love you, to stay right there in that chair. Because there's nothing greater that we could offer to God as a legacy of our life than that we have helped our children and grandchildren develop a relationship with God where they know God and what He is doing. Not only what He's done. What He's doing. God's working today. There's no question about that. Are we willing to work with Him? Is the only question. Won't you work with God today? And if we can help you do that, let us know while we stand and sing.